This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nobody really talks about poverty anymore. When policymakers talk about the economy at all, it's about jobs. And if you're among the 7 to 8% of the population who are unemployed, then yes, maybe a job would be better than nothing. But remember, 92% of the population, at least the working age population, have jobs, and still poverty rates are growing. They're at the highest rate in more than 50 years and climbing. So having a job doesn't mean you're not in rough shape, just one paycheck or one illness away from losing everything. 18% of our neighbors here in North Carolina are considered poor. Organizations like the North Carolina Justice Center and the Durham People's Alliance are dedicated to keeping the fight against poverty alive. Tonight, the two groups are going to screen the film American Winter. That movie follows eight families struck into poverty by the 2008 economic recession. And joining us now to talk about that is one of the directors, Harry Gantz. Welcome, Harry.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. You have worked on other programs, Taxi Cab Confessions, for instance, for HBO. Why did you decide to tackle the subject of poverty?
Well, my brother and I had seen several films that addressed the reasons or the causes of the Great Recession, but very few on the human impact. And we got interested when we read an article about the 211 system, which is the number you call in most cities and states if you need some type of social services. So we started listening in on some calls in some of these call centers up and down the West Coast, and we're just amazed at the sort of the sea of suffering that we heard. Many of them formerly middle-class people who were calling for services for the first time, and you know, it was almost like the deer in the headlight. They couldn't believe they were in that position, and that sort of inspired us to make the film.
Well, let's talk about one of those families, John, a 50-year-old man, and his 10-year-old son, Gerald. Gerald has Down syndrome, and I want to hear a clip from the film right now.
I was working for a Columbia Sportswear, making about $55,000, $56,000 a year as a cost accountant, and then I got laid off.
Okay, come on, back up a little.
My parents, they live about 490 miles away. They run a cattle ranch up there in north central Washington. We take the horses and train them, and then my parents use them up in the Cascade Mountains. I've been working since I was 10, 12 years old. Anyone worth their salt wants to work. I'll scrub toilets, so I'm not too good to do, you know, I'm not above doing any kind of work.
That was a clip from the movie American Winter. It's showing tonight, 7 o'clock, at Motorco Music Hall here in Durham, talking to one of the filmmakers, Harry Gantz. Harry, tell us a little bit more about John and Gerald.
Well, John, like you said, has been working his entire life, and he's in a position not like many other people who are over 50, unemployed for the first time, not necessarily up to speed on their skills at job interviewing and all the things it takes to sell yourself out in the marketplace, and starting over at even the position he has now. I mean, he had originally as a cost analyst, they're hiring people at a fee of $35,000 a year. So the idea that you can get back and get to the same lifestyle that you had is just unrealistic in this economy, and there's many, many people in his position. He's still in a position where he's about to lose his house. He's put off the auction and foreclosure the best he can over the last 6 or 8 months, but he's gotten recent notices that they are moving forward with it, and he's, you know, in the same sort of desperate situation, unemployed and about to lose his home.
And making $55,000 a year at one point, so that means that a job with a pretty good income doesn't really, it goes awfully fast, that just having that job, even with a pretty good income, doesn't keep you from poverty very long if the bottom falls out.
Exactly. Well, he had saved up a lot of money, but, you know, even when his unemployment ran out and his savings ran out, he's back to, you know, doing whatever he can to survive.
American Winter is being filmed. It was filmed actually one winter in Portland, Oregon. The problem of poverty, of course, nationwide, including here in North Carolina. Joining us now to focus on the problem here is Tazra Mitchell. She is a fellow at the Budget and Tax Center at North Carolina Justice Center. Tazra, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the Justice Center. And you moved here from, is this a national organization?
This is a state-level organization.
What are you finding here in North Carolina?
So Just a little bit about the Justice Center very briefly. We're at our core, we're an anti-poverty organization, so we do a lot of research around this in North Carolina. And in North Carolina, the poverty rate has risen 25% just since the start of the Great Recession. And even though we are 4 years into the economic recovery, nearly one in five North Carolinians still live in poverty. And the rate is even higher for our children. And when you look at children of color, those rates are approaching 40 to 50% for certain communities. And not only does it impact individuals differently, but it also impacts certain communities differently. In North Carolina, there are very high poverty rates in rural areas and inner city areas. But over the last decade, suburban areas are also experiencing skyrocketing levels of poverty. Over the 2000s, suburban neighborhoods in North Carolina, the number of people who are poor rose by 40%.
So the numbers are rising. Wait a minute. So we're hearing that there's a recovery, and we might think, okay, well, there's a lag time. It takes time to catch up to everybody. But you're saying it's not even a matter of them not catching up. It's getting worse.
Well, it was getting worse. So from 2010 to 2011, the number of people who were poor in North Carolina rose. But taking into account population growth, that change was not statistically significant, but it's still very high.
Right. So what are the reasons? Is it because we're just not catching up to the so-called recovery? Because Wall Street's doing great.
Right.
They're doing fine.
It's really been about the tale of two economies. The weak recovery is eluding a lot of families, and certainly the American dream is in jeopardy in North Carolina. There's a very and the American winter is all about the hauling away of the middle class and the pulling away at the top. But the reality is, in North Carolina, there's only one job available for every three unemployed workers. So if folks can't access those jobs and lost their jobs during the recovery through no fault of their own, then the wages, they just live in poverty.
Well, and apparently the wages don't help much if the next bump comes along. And part of the problem is even that when assistance is available, sometimes getting the assistance is difficult. I want to play another clip from American Winter. This is a different couple. This is Ben and Paula.
I was working for Volkswagen Credit. Company cars, new car every year, made every bonus.
But things changed.
Baby comes along and
got
she's
pregnant.
Got health problems.
And then, he lost his job.
We were already starting to get a little bit behind on our mortgage. I called them and he said that we can modify your loan and, get you a lower payment. And he said, but you're not far enough behind yet. You need to be 90 days behind before we can help you. And that to me sounded crazy. I was like, what?
Take the whole box, get into the U-Haul.
Okay. But they said, don't make any payments until we can modify this loan. Then in September, they say, we're so sorry. You don't qualify for anything. And we need $17,000 in 5 days.
There we go. A clip from the film American Winter, showing tonight, 7 o'clock, Motorco in Durham. Talking to one of the filmmakers, Harry Gantz. Tazra Mitchell is here from the North Carolina Justice Center. Harry, tell us a little bit more about Ben and Paula.
Well, Ben and Paula, were one of the couples that and families that I had talked earlier about. Formerly middle class, doing very well, and the bottom dropped out. A combination of things. As Nick Fish, one of the people in the film, says, we're in a one-strike-and-you're-out economy. But they had two strikes. One is he lost his job, and two is they had a child born that had some medical issues at birth. So those two things, losing your job, of course, you lose your health insurance with that. And those two whammies just sent them on a downward spiral that they're just now starting to come out of, with both of them working. But they'll never get back to the place in their minds. They'll never get back to the place they were, which was, on the road to the American dream.
Well, and it's also talks a little bit about the role of our private financial, privately financed, publicly traded corporations, and the role that banks played in this. You don't have to have an MBA from Harvard to know that getting into more trouble is not your way out. It did sound odd to Paula. The banker said it was the best thing in the world, and of course, was he lying or was he just mistaken?
Well, you know, it's not for me to speak on the history of their relationship with the bank, because we got into their story afterwards. To us, it's more, we are showing the emotional, personal turmoil that it takes on these families who are just one step away from being homeless. Some of them in the film, as you see, do end up becoming homeless. And that fortitude it takes for these families. They are not the takers that Romney described. Most of them are hardworking people who only want the dignity of providing for their family. And the people who commit fraud, whether it's in the public assistance or any of these social service problems, are just a very minute part of the people who are receiving assistance.
Well, the problem is probably not going to be solved at the state and federal level alone. Localities also play a role in this. Carl Rist is with us. He is co-president of the Durham People's Alliance and also vice president for the Corporation for Enterprise Development in Washington, D.C. Carl Rist, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
What is the well, tell us about the Durham People's Alliance first. Tell us what you do.
Right. So the People's Alliance is a local citizen organization committed to social and economic justice in Durham. We've been around for about 35 years. We're totally member-funded with 700 members, strong and growing. We envision Durham as a place with a safe environment, safe neighborhoods, quality public education, and people-centered economic development. So we've been concerned for a long time about shared prosperity here and making sure that economic development in Durham works for all of our citizens.
You pay a lot of attention to and have written a report on what it takes to build wealth, not just income, not just a $25 an hour job that once you lose it, you could be homeless. But wealth building, what do you mean? What's the distinction here between wealth and income? I don't get it.
Right. So a lot of what we've been talking about here is poverty rates and income poverty and income inequality. But certainly the way that families get ahead and stay ahead is not only how much you earn day to day and how you get by day to day, but how much you own, how much you have to invest in the future or to protect your family if there's a crisis, if you lose a job, as we heard from the filmmaker in the clips there. So we did a study here in Durham with some unique data sets that was supported by the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation and the city's Department of Community Development. And we found that 35% of families in Durham County are asset poor. That means they lack the cash reserves or the liquid reserves or even net worth to survive for 3 months at the poverty line if they were to lose their job or source of income. And that means for a family of four, it's a little more than $3,000 or $4,000. So it's not a big wealth cushion. But that shows these are families that are living on the edge. And as a filmmaker said, are kind of one crisis away from real disaster. And those numbers are worse for families in different targeted economic groups or demographic groups. So, for example, families of color are one in two are asset poor in Durham County. We also know that families with children are also much more likely to be asset poor. So this speaks to the larger sort of span of Americans, both in our cities but also in suburbs, who are very much close to financial insecurity.
So what you're saying is when you're asset poor, 35% of the families in Durham County fall into that category. Asset poor, not only is there no cushion, but there's no way to really invest. So when Tasver talks about two economies, Wall Street and you know, well, financial reporters say, oh, the economy is improving, but all they mean is Wall Street is getting better. Meanwhile, this 35% doesn't have anything left at the end of the month to invest in the second economy, or perhaps the first economy, in Wall Street to build wealth that they can then pass on to their children the way perhaps some wealthy people
earn
their wealth.
Or to invest in the way that Americans have done for years. This is really the American dream, to buy a house, to start a business, to go to college. These are the things that you can do with a little bit of wealth. It doesn't take huge wealth endowments, but some funds to really make that springboard to let families invest for the future for themselves and their kids.
So, Tazra, is this just a way of sort of figuring out a way to access the private markets? What role does government play in all of this, do you think?
So I think government has a very important role in reversing the long-running structural changes in the economy is very important. So reversing that trend requires adequate and long-term investments in economic policies. So it's great that the GDP is increasing. It's great that our economy is improving. But looking at the quality of that growth is very important. And government has a very good role. And for instance, one of those long-term investments could be generating jobs that pay living wages. So looking at raising the minimum wage, ensuring gender equity, and also there are programs, so job training that supports career mobility. But if I could just quickly say that government has a very important role, and especially now when North Carolina is facing this very deep economic hole. Rather than digging North Carolina out of the hole, lawmakers are making it worse by dismantling the public investments that are the foundation for a very strong economy. So we've talked a lot about joblessness. the first 2 weeks that the legislature was in session, they chose to dismantle the unemployment system. And that, you know, unemployment and insurance, those benefits are very important to families who are struggling to make ends meet. And it's a very modest support.
Well, a couple of extra weeks of unemployment, right, it could be the difference between keeping a house and not. And that
right.
house is your investment in the future. You're actually building equity right. or wealth in the house. If I lose it because you cut off my unemployment benefits 6 weeks earlier than you could have, now my wealth is gone as well as my income.
Right. And those are dollars that could be spent in the local economies, not only making sure that that the families are doing well. But something that was very striking in the film is the conditions of the children. Those children, a lot of children who grow up in poverty know way too much for their age. And it's very clear in the film the stress that living in poverty and worrying about whether or not you're going to have your next meal or if you're going to be kicked out of your home, it weighs very heavy on the children.
And I think you pointed out something interesting. When you create programs that put wealth back into the community, the money doesn't get burned in a furnace. It actually right. gets spent and circulated. But people will argue, look, if to do this, you're going to have to raise taxes in order to create the programs you're talking about, to extend unemployment, to extend Medicaid benefits to 500,000 people. Well, no, that wouldn't have cost us money. In fact, we would add federal money. We lost that. But all right, that one aside, that it's going to cost us money. But so what about that? What about if I raise taxes, nobody's going to want to move to North Carolina and then there won't be jobs. What about that?
Well, first, there's a lot of evidence that shows that raising taxes doesn't, for the most part, doesn't cause people to flee the state. But in order for us to have safe communities, for us to ensure a quality education for our children, it requires raising or, you know, generating tax collections. But just look at what legislative leadership is pursuing. They're not just pursuing tax reform that would keep revenue collections at the current level. They are cutting. They are pursuing policies that would cut taxes for people at the top and raise them on the bottom. So
in particular, you're talking about raising taxes from 2% to 6.5% on food.
Food. These are basic necessities right. and out-of-pocket medical expenses such right. as prescriptions. So there are choices that we can make, and raising revenue to support adequate public investments is one of them. I think Carl wants to.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, you know, let's talk about what we can do in Durham. You know. We know that the federal government is pretty much bankrupt at this point and is not providing a lot of support. The state government is pulling back their support. So one thing that we've been talking about here in Durham, and one thing that a lot of leading cities are doing around the country that are really thinking about how to empower families financially, is to make sure all families have a chance to file taxes and to receive that earned income tax credit that the federal government provides, and we provided at the state level until it now has been eliminated by our legislature. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Durham, there's a group called Reinvestment Partners that provides free tax assistance to about 1,000 families per year in Durham. And they bring back about $750,000 to our local economy. These are dollars that come from the federal government. It's not increasing taxes in Durham, but it means these are dollars that will circulate in the local economy. So we're urging the county commissioners to keep investing in this kind of work and even invest more in this so more families can file taxes and get back that tax credit that can really help their basic checkbook, but also support the local economy.
What are other things that can happen at the government and the local and even grassroots level to help people of modest wealth, modest income build wealth?
Right. A couple things. So here in Durham, there's a small program at the Department of Community Development called Individual Development Accounts. These are matched savings accounts for families of lower incomes. If they save a dollar, they get a dollar or two match for their savings. We'd like to see that kind of program increase so more adults of lower means can have a chance to save and build wealth towards these specific investments like education or homes or business. One thing we'd love to see in Durham as well that's a real model program that comes from San Francisco is something called Kindergarten to College. So right now, this is not really well known in this country, but in the city of San Francisco, every child that enters public kindergarten receives a savings account dedicated to college in their name when they enroll in school. So this is a way to begin building wealth for all kids from the earliest years, and we think that's something we should consider.
Where does the money come from for that account?
So the money for the initial deposit comes from taxpayers in San Francisco, but then the private sector is now providing dollars to support matching funds to encourage families to save in those accounts. So that's the kind of very modest wealth building we think should happen in cities across the country.
On the State of Things today, talking with Carl Rist. He's the co-president of the Durham People's Alliance, vice president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, Washington, D.C. Tazra Mitchell is also with us, the fellow at the Budget and Tax Center in North Carolina's Justice Center. And Harry Gantz, who is an Emmy Award-winning director of the film American Winter. American Winter will show tonight, 7 o'clock, Motor Co. in Durham. It is free and open to the public. Is it?
Yes, sir.
It is.
Come join us,
Frank. Open to the public, 7 o'clock, Motorcoat tonight in Durham. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the solutions to poverty in North Carolina. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The United States is one of the richest countries in the world, and it's also one of the poorest, at least among developing countries. How'd that happen? North Carolina has the 12th highest poverty rate in this nation, which is one of the poorest in the developed world. So now, joining us now to talk about poverty and how it can be addressed in North Carolina, Gene Nickel. He's professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity there. Gene, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Frank. Nice to hear you again.
Also joining us by phone, Brian Balfour, director of policy and operations for the Civitas Institute. Brian, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Gene, poverty rate, North Carolina, 18%. How come?
Well, the poverty rate rose in North Carolina from 2000 to 2008 as the economy was expanding. When the economy hit the skids in 2008, poverty exploded in North Carolina. There are structural causes for it. There are public policy causes for it. There are individual causes for it. But the long and short of it is North Carolina, the United States has become, as you said, the richest, the poorest, and the most unequal of any advanced nation. In North Carolina, those figures and those separations are even worse. So that 18% of us live in poverty, and it's wrenching poverty. 40% of children of color, an amazing statistic that you would think would humiliate us to have announced as a principle. And as you know, we've been doing a lot of sort of on-the-ground work, trying to look beyond those numbers, talking to homeless, 250 homeless vets in Fayetteville, fresh from our nation's battlefields, living under the highways and in the wood lines. Just back from Greensboro, Greensboro and High Point, the second highest food insecurity in the United States. Something you don't hear about, a remarkable statistic, Robeson County having among the highest poverty levels in the country. It's surprising that we went through a gubernatorial race, we've gone through a legislative session. These are never discussed. You said, for example, that we have the 12th highest poverty rate, which is true. A decade ago, Frank, it was 26th. We were a little better than average. So we are speeding past our colleagues, and yet this issue is invisible from our discourse.
Brian Balfour, why?
Well, a increase in poverty is attributable to a lack of opportunities, and specifically lack of wealth creation, capital investment on behalf of entrepreneurs. And certainly we can, I think one thing we can agree on is that state policies can be attributable to that impact. And one thing that we've looked at Civitas is kind of underscoring what Mr. Nickel said. There has been a significant flatlining and even a decrease in North Carolina's economic trajectory. You certainly look at back to the 1980s and 1990s, North Carolina was an economic growth leader in the country. But certainly in the last dozen years or so, there's a pretty sharp inflection point right around 1999 and 2000 where we really see job growth and income growth and opportunities really, as I mentioned, flatlining and decreasing compared to those previous trend lines. So really I think something to be said to really start to evaluate and examine some of these policies that have been in place in the last dozen years or so that really prompted that inflection point.
What do you think some of those policies are?
One thing that's a big topic this session is North Carolina's tax code. And when you look at North Carolina's overall tax burden, during the 1980s and 90s, it was lower than the national average. Since the year 2000, it has been higher than the national average. So certainly, taxes aren't everything, but they certainly are a contributing factor. And I think that's one thing that obviously the General Assembly is attempting to address this session.
Well, you wrote a piece and you said it's no coincidence that North Carolina, with its over-reliance on personal and corporate income taxes, is suffering from the fifth highest unemployment rate in the nation. Made me wonder who had the highest unemployment rate. So I checked. It's Nevada, zero income tax, and the ninth lowest overall taxes in the country. So apparently there's no real correlation between unemployment and taxes, because otherwise Nevada would have to have the lowest unemployment rate.
Well, certainly that's one outlier, but when you look at, I mean, you can look back at 50 years worth of data when you evaluate states with tax structures, and those states, you know, consistently that perform better are those with low or no income taxes relative to the other states. So I think that, you know, the body of evidence is pretty overwhelming, you know, relative to one specific outlier. And certainly Nevada, in their situation, having been hit particularly hard with the real estate implosion, is certainly, you know, you look prior to the recession, they were actually experiencing pretty robust growth.
Well, Gene, what about that? If we raise taxes to create programs, it's going to discourage business, and that's going to make things worse then.
Frank, let me try to put that in perspective for just a second. Begin with the factual description that you and Tazra went through that we just started with. That is, we're in a big hole. North Carolina's largest problem is poverty. Its largest problem is the lack of fairness, the lack of opportunity for poor and low-income people. Now, to me, what that suggests is what ought to drive our decision-making. I am in favor of anything that makes it better for people in the bottom third. I am opposed to anything that makes it worse for people in the bottom third. And I would add to that, I'm old, and I no longer buy the notion that you're going to make things better by some sort of hocus pocus. If you simply make things better for rich people, then poor people are going to thrive and prosper. Now, if that's true, if that's your framework, I want you to think for just a minute about what we've done in the last 4 months. We have rejected 500,000 people from Medicaid. We have knocked 170,000 people off of unemployment where the money was already paid. We have raised the taxes of 900,000 North Carolinians by eliminating the earned income tax credit. At the other end, we've eliminated an estate tax. We have reintroduced payday lending. We're going to have drug tests for people getting food stamps. And now we want to change our tax policy towards sales taxes and sales taxes on food and on medicine to reduce income taxes, so that our pattern of the last 4 months is massively regressive. Not partly regressive, not a tiny bit regressive. It is massively regressive. And so it's impossible to support. If you're looking at the interest of the state as a whole, it's impossible to support these recent changes. I would just add one final thing. That is, there's also this argument, which is afoot now, that we need to, in effect, adopt the Confederacy economic structure. That, you know, we need to have to eliminate all taxes so that we look like all the states here in the South. Now, what you'd want to add to that is poverty is highest in the South. It's highest in the South by far. So the general presumption and ambition that if we can just replicate the social structure of the other southern states, we're going to thrive is massively counterfactual. It's also at odds with our history. We dug our way out from the bottom of the ranks of the South through investment in our people and places. And we had a long run with the sort of test of having the poorest public structure, the poorest public facilities, the least productive workers in education. We tried that for a very long time. And, you know, in 1960, they weren't saying thank God for Mississippi and Louisiana. They're saying thank God for North Carolina. And our history suggests that this approach is not going to be our way to prosperity.
Well, let's talk about another aspect of this then. There's one way, of course, we can do this is to raise money. There's a debate about how to do that. But then there's a decision to cut benefits, cut unemployment benefits, move 500 or keep 500 people off the 500,000 people off the Medicaid rolls and turn back federal money to do that. Brian, why do those things?
Well, first off, addressing the unemployment insurance issue. The state of North Carolina owes more than $2.5 billion to the federal government, and that's in addition to roughly about $7 billion or more in state debt that we're staring at. Also, about $2.5-3 billion in unfunded liabilities for the state pension plan, and roughly about $30 billion in unfunded liabilities for retirees' health benefits for state employees. So the question becomes, you know, where do we get the money to pay off this debt? And getting back to the unemployment insurance issue, you know, the decision that was made was to limit the length of benefits and limit the size of the benefits that certain unemployed folks receive, you know, but what was the alternative? Well, to increase the taxes on employers. So what kind of, I mean, what kind of incentive system does that put into place? I mean, it's a commonly repeated refrain that the more you tax something, the less of that you get. So the more we tax job creators, the less job creation we're going to get. On the flip side, the more you subsidize something, the more you subsidize something, the more of that you get.
It does create a picture, though, doesn't it? I mean, there's a pattern, isn't it? Well, we're not going to hurt the employers, so we'll put it on the backs of the employees. We're not going to cut everybody's taxes. We'll raise tax on food, and we'll cut out the earned income tax credit. Brian, are you concerned that we're creating a kind of portrait where all of the benefits seem to be going to people who have more wealth, and a lot of the pressures and burdens seem to be falling more and more to people with less wealth? Does it appear to be that happening to you?
Oh, quite the reverse. I mean, Mr. Nickel laid out the poverty rates and the unemployment rates for North Carolina. It appears that the policies of the last decade are the ones that have been hitting the poor the hardest. And what we're trying to do is reverse that trend. I mean, the benefits that accrue for a growing economy accrue most concentrated among those folks on the margins of employment and the low income levels. And so what we're trying to do, what we'd like to see in North Carolina is, again, getting back to tax policy, is something that's going to attract investment and entrepreneurs to North Carolina to create jobs, to get those folks who are currently unemployed, to get them working, to attract greater capital investment, to increase productivity of the employers. Companies that hire people, is that increased productivity, which increases wages. So really it's about expanding the opportunities for those folks that really need it most, not about, it's kind of a silly notion, I think that these benefits just simply accrue to the rich and what are they going to do, just stuff the money in their mattress or something like that? No, they use that money, they go out and hire people. They hire the people that need the jobs, and they grow and expand the economy, and those benefits accrue to those folks who most desperately need it.
Well, one way you could do that, though, rather than attract investment, others say is to actually build investment and build wealth within your own state. One way you might do that is to allow a state bank to operate, and that would allow loans to go to smaller businesses, things that commercial banks can't finance, but with state backing, you'd have wealth generated within a community that right now can't get commercial loans. You think that's a very, very bad idea. Why?
That's a terrible idea. I mean, that's right of the Karl Marx playbook, state-owned banks. I mean, why do we want to centralize and politicize even more of our economy? And now we're going to politicize and put in the hands of political bureaucrats investment decisions to control the means of production here. And where is the state bank going to get the money from? Of course, they're going to have to tax it out from the productive sector of the economy. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And by definition, any state-owned bank would be extending loans to those business startups and entrepreneurs that could not get money on the private sector, which means they're far more risky. So what happens if there's a higher default rate on these loans from the state-owned banks? Who's going to bail them out? The taxpayers.
Yeah, but you know, it seems to me that it wasn't state-owned banks that caused this.
Bank of America is digging deep in a settlement with mortgage bond investors over claims the bank knowingly sold investments filled with bad loans. The bank has agreed to pay $8.5 billion to bond investors, $5.5 billion to other mortgage bond investors, and another $6.4 billion in other charges linked to mortgages. The settlement could pressure other big banks to resolve similar allegations.
It was private banks, not state banks, that crashed the economy in 2008. They were the ones trading in bad loans, and there was no transparency at all. When Brooksley Bourne tried to get some transparency about those instruments that they were using that nobody understood, it was a Democrat, Bill Clinton, who fired her and said, no, we will not have transparency. Isn't there more transparency in the government where political officials would have to stand re-election if there was corruption in that bank than there is on Wall Street, where you fire the regulator who says, hey, something's going on, it's going to crash the economy?
Well, you talk about private banks. I mean, they're nominally private, but let's look at the incentive structure that was put into banks. I mean, there's been plenty of books written about what happened in the financial crisis of a few years ago, and all the incentive structures that were put into place that the banks were facing. I mean, that was the inevitable result. I mean, you look at all the federal government programs to try to increase home ownership and to waive, you know, sound underwriting standards. There's international accords, international agreements on bank risk management that really pushed banks in this direction. I mean, they responded perfectly rationally to the incentive structures that was put into place by government policies.
Gene, Nickel?
Frank, you have to let me go back for a minute to these earlier statements that we've got massive poverty, massive economic injustice, massive deprivation in North Carolina. It's of long standing and it's growing. And therefore, we need to take a series of steps which are tremendously regressive, and we need to step on the necks of those very folks in Medicaid, in unemployment, in earned income tax credit, in the changes that are coming in sales tax, which mean repeatedly that higher income people will pay less, lower income people will pay more. You can say that things haven't been working very well, so we're going to try a different theory and we're going to step on the neck more profoundly of low income people. I guess you could also say things aren't working very well, so we're going to stop low income people from going to school or having a job. And that's going to be a sort of gauntlet of change. This is an absurd notion that, take my word for it, just be a little more generous to rich people and then people at the bottom are going to thrive.
Well, thank you both. Gene Nickel, professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity. Ryan Belfort, director of policy and operations at the Civitas Institute. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.